From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Governor-elect Larry Hogan ran on the campaign promise of balancing the state budget and cutting taxes. The budget will be the big issue of the General Assembly that convenes next week. We talk with a professor and a reporter about how a Republican governor might deal with a Democratic legislature to balance the budget. Then, how closely should an historical film hew to the historical record? We explore fact and fiction in the new film, Selma, about Martin Luther King Jr. and the push for the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And the 12 people gunned down in the terror attack in Paris at the satirical French newspaper Charlie Hebdo included some celebrated cartoonists. Tom Hall talks with political cartoonist Cal, Kevin Kelleher, about the value of satire. First news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland's incoming governor, Republican Larry Hogan, will take office in less than 2 weeks. He's named several cabinet secretaries, but not a budget secretary, and he's due to present his budget plan to the General Assembly just 2 days after he's sworn in as governor January 21st. Hogan's campaign platform centered on cutting taxes, which he says are driving people and businesses out of the state. Hogan has indicated that state agencies and Baltimore City should brace for a change. Here he is at a press conference in mid-December, criticizing the budget performance of the O'Malley administration.
They drained our checking, saving, and retirement accounts. They maxed out every credit card. They tapped into the Christmas fund, the college tuition funds. They even broke into every one of the kids' piggy banks. And we still don't have enough to pay the bills.
So the question is, how will a Republican governor work with a Democratic legislature to balance the budget? With me in the studio is Roy Myers, professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. He's looked at congressional, state, and federal budget transparency. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Sheila.
And joining me on the phone from Annapolis is Brian Sears, government reporter for the Daily Record. He's been following Governor-elect Hogan's transition. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with some of Larry Hogan's promises during his campaign. He talked about ongoing deficits and bringing Maryland's budget back into balance. Brian Sears, from what you observed during the campaign and since the election, what first steps are you expecting from Governor-elect Hogan?
The governor-elect is really going to have to prioritize what he does. And I think the first priority here comes with balancing the budget and erasing the structural deficit. You're looking at a structural deficit over the next 18 months of roughly $1 to $1.1 billion. And before the governor-elect can hope to do anything like raise taxes or even start to think about paying for new programs that people might want, he's going to have to tame that budget. And he's drawing himself a pretty small box by saying all of the things that he's not going to do, like do these transfers from special funds or declare a fiscal emergency that would allow him to tap into the money from the gas tax that goes into the highway user funds.
I just want to correct a small misspeak on your part before we go further. You said before he can think about raising taxes, and you meant...
I beg your pardon. Yeah, before he can think about lowering taxes. And that really has been a priority. He's talked about wanting to roll back as many of the O'Malley tax hikes as he can. But that's not going to happen until the budget gets back into balance.
Professor Myers, what do you expect Governor-elect Hogan to focus on?
I think he's going to have to have a serious negotiation with the legislature about mandated and entitlement spending. Most of his claims during the campaign were vague. They were metaphors, like the tape that you showed, that you ran, talked about piggy banks and the Christmas fund and so on. Well, he's going to be governor soon, and he's going to have to deal with the realities of the state finances, which are much more complicated than he let on during his campaign. And one of the realities is that cutting discretionary spending, where he has a tremendous amount of power, is not going to be sufficient to reduce the amount of spending that he wants to do. And he's going to have to negotiate with legislative leaders regarding, for example, education formulas for the county boards of education, or Medicaid reimbursements. And those are very, very difficult programs to cut, both in terms of the program design and the politics.
I've read that about $4 out of $5 the state spends is mandated, is controlled by a formula or some law that the legislature has previously passed. So are we talking about changing all those laws in addition to a budget process?
Well, every year the governor makes a budget proposal, but that budget proposal includes not only recommended spending levels for agency operations, which the legislature can't increase, but also asks for changes in those laws. And they're normally packaged in a law called the BRFA, the Budget Reconciliation Financing Act. So if he's going to reduce education spending or Medicaid spending or many other programs that guarantee that spending will go up in the future years, he's going to have to use that mechanism. And that will require him to reach a compromise, an agreement with the legislative leadership and membership of the General Assembly.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Brian Sears, government reporter for The Daily Record, and Roy Myers, political and public policy professor at UMBC. Professor Myers, you alluded a few minutes ago to the power that the governor has in the budget process. That's really what makes Maryland's process unique compared to other states, right, is that Maryland's governor has more power.
Yeah, there's no question that the governor has very strong what we call proposal power. That is, the legislature has a harder time adding to his recommended level of spending than other legislatures in other states have. In addition,
can they add at all? I was under the impression they could only cut.
Yes, they can add. They can add, for example, by dedicating revenues for a particular purpose, but most importantly, by writing a law that mandates spending in future years, which is one of the reasons that we have higher education spending. That was what happened under the Thornton or the Bridge to Excellence legislation that dramatically increased state aid to local school boards. The incoming governor, Governor-elect Hogan's real powers are in the future will not just be his ability to propose a budget, but to propose structural changes in how the government actually works. You know, if we're going to save money in public safety, we're going to have to think about prison sentencing. If we're going to save money in health spending, we're going to have to think about how the state effectively carries out a very interesting Medicare waiver that we agreed to with the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, that
which has to do with how hospitals are reimbursed.
Right, and that's going, and not just hospitals, but in fact doctors actually under this new plan, and that kind of structural change is what is going to be needed to have the state's spending become more efficient.
Professor Myers, do you see our situation as a budget crisis?
I think we have a budget problem, not a crisis. I think we use this term crisis far too much when we talk about budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Every year there's going to be a challenge in budgeting because that's the nature of budgeting, in that we have lots of different desires and wants and needs, however you define that, and a limit on the amount of money that we have. And sometimes that limit is surprisingly low compared to what we expected, as what happened over the period from 2008 on. So when you talk about the structural deficit that Brian mentioned, of over $1 billion. Well, that was the annual budget deficit in 2009 and 2010. I mean, so in fact, it was almost $2 billion in 1 year. So I would say that was a crisis. What we have now is a problem. It's a rather traditional problem, and it's one where it would be best for us as a state to think a bit outside the box. In that sense, I think it's good that Governor-elect Hogan has come into office with a willingness to challenge some of the traditional assumptions in Annapolis about what's appropriate spending. But that won't be sufficient. The idea that all we need to do is just cut agency operations and somehow free business to be more competitive, I think that's a rather limited approach to dealing with the challenges that we face.
Let me follow up on something else. You said that one of the ways the state legislature can sort of protect its budget goals is passing laws that mandate formulas that will affect future budgets. But when it comes to a current year's budget. What can legislative leaders do to protect spending that a governor wants to cut? Is there anything they can do?
No, that's much more difficult. It's no question. That's where the governor is quite powerful. And not just when the legislature is in session, but when, especially when the legislature leaves, if he can get the vote of, say, Comptroller Francho in the Board of Public Works, the Board of Public Works can cut spending that's discretionary spending by up to 25% in any account, as, in fact, the governor just did yesterday, I should say Wednesday, and has done, I think, 9 times during his 2 terms.
Brian, have you in your coverage of the legislature seen any legislative maneuvers that succeeded in protecting spending that a governor wanted to cut?
Well, there's always a certain amount of, for lack of a better term, horse trading. There are ways to negotiate things. Certainly, the higher up you go on the food chain in the legislature, the better chance you have of being able to hold up things that a governor might want. I'll give you a really good example. Last year, Senator Thomas Middleton was able to hold up the minimum wage bill in order to get the state to agree to provide additional payments to caregivers of developmentally disabled people so that their salaries could keep pace with the minimum wage. That was something that ultimately the governor in his reductions last week cut in half. But, you know, but the legislature is able to, through a number of ways, take priorities that the administration might very much want to see pass and use them to bargain for things that they want.
Yeah, that's a great example. The difference, though, between that and what may happen in the future is that those are members of the same party. And now we have a divided government in this state, and that there's a very strong incentive for Governor Hogan to distinguish himself from the Democrats and to try and create a image of fiscal rectitude. And I think while that has dangers, of course, because most of the time when you cut spending, there are going to be aggrieved beneficiaries and aggrieved providers. Nevertheless, he certainly ran for office on a platform that resonated with many people across the state regarding economic competitiveness and government spending. So to the extent that he can set up situations where he can demonstrate that he is cutting compared to what the Democrats want, it might be a plausible electoral strategy for 4 years from now, certainly.
Well, as I said, the budget is going to be the huge issue in the General Assembly, the session that starts next week. I hope we can count on both of you to keep us posted.
Will do.
As it unfolds.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Roy Myers is Professor of Political Science and Affiliate Professor of Public Policy at UMBC. Brian Sears is a government reporter for the Daily Record who's been following Governor-elect Hogan's transition. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast ahead on Maryland Morning, the fact and fiction in the new movie Selma. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Stirner. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A this morning with Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. Mr. Dietz, good to see you, sir.
Good morning.
And joining us on the phone from Iowa is Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
And we understand that you are in Iowa visiting family because there has been a death in the family, so our condolences to you and to them. But thank you for joining us this morning. I want to talk about this very, what's turned out to be a pretty controversial movie, Selma, which, of course, depicts that period in 1965 where Dr. King led a famous march from Selma to Montgomery. First major feature film for a director called Ava DuVernay, who spent about 14 years, I guess, as a publicist in Hollywood. Interesting backstory. Anne Hornaday, you wrote a really interesting piece about Selma and about this notion of the filmmaker's obligation for historical accuracy when you're doing a dramatic narrative. A lot of people have questioned some of the historical facts as they are portrayed in Selma. What do you think about that? And also, Anne, what do you think about the movie itself?
Well, I'll begin by saying I loved the movie. I just think it's an extraordinary accomplishment on the part of Ava. It's the first time in 50 years that we've seen Dr. King represented in a major feature film, which is really the grammar of our culture. And to just even just the fact of the film itself is such a triumph, and it's so beautifully directed and beautifully acted. And it does address the relationship between Dr. King and Lyndon Baines Johnson, who's played by Tom Wilkinson in the film, in another wonderful performance. And a lot of, you know, Johnson advisors and historians have taken issue with the way their relationship is portrayed, especially meetings that happen in the White House, where you can see Johnson trying to get King to support his war on poverty before he addresses voting rights, because he's so exhausted from having just passed the Civil Rights Bill the year before. And I think my first, you know, I think my first comment would be that I take issue with the premise that Johnson is portrayed as a villain in the film. I don't think he is. I think he's portrayed as a brilliant, beleaguered, burdened politician who is triangulating between all manner of interests and wants to support King, tells him early in the film, "I want to help, tell me how." And then you just see them negotiate, navigate, horse trade, and force, you know, King sort of forces Johnson's hand at certain points, much to Johnson's, you know, Johnson kind of needs to be prodded just politically. And he gets one of the most soaringly inspiring moments of the film when he delivers that great speech to Congress. But that aside, I do take those comments from firsthand witnesses and historians seriously, and I think they've really brought a lot of value, you know, to the conversation. But what I would want to advocate for is listening and respecting what they have to say and valuing it, but also seeing the, you know, please see the movie and have that emotional experience, because it's a powerful artistic emotional experience that I would hate for people to miss out on if they, you know, thinking that one has to trump the other.
And Jed Dietz, even the people criticizing the movie disagree with themselves about what the shortcomings of the movie may or may not be. Johnson is, as Anne alluded to, depicted in some people's minds as the sort of the bad guy in this thing. Joe Califano, who worked in the Johnson administration, wrote a searing essay in the Washington Post a couple weeks ago, going so far as to say that the march on from Selma to Montgomery was Johnson's idea. And there's certainly an awful lot of historians who would dispute that contention. Where do you stand when it comes to, you know, this isn't a documentary. This is a narrative story, and it's being told dramatically with, as Anne mentioned, you know, fantastic performances. David Oyelowo plays Dr. King. What's the responsibility of a filmmaker when you're depicting an event or events in history?
Well, I would say the responsibility of the audience, whether you're watching a documentary or a feature film, is to always keep in your mind that you're seeing everything you're seeing is through the eyes of one filmmaker. And it's their interpretation, it's their memory, it's their set of facts. And that doesn't make it wrong, and I agree with Anne. I think everybody should see this movie. It's horrifying to me that it took 50 years to get this story told in a feature film. And now that it's told, what I would urge is go see this movie and then go read it at Canaan's Edge, Taylor Branch's book about Selma, which will, the movie's riddled with so-called errors. I mean, James Bevel was the guy who came up with the idea of marching to Montgomery, not exactly. Dr. King. He was the one who spoke after Jimmie Lee Jackson's murder, as it's, and Dr. King is depicted doing it in the movie. But what's important is what Anne said. I mean, I think this is an extraordinary story. It's an extraordinary part of American history, one of the most seminal events. And now it's on film. Go see it. and then read more about it. You know, let it take you into the story.
But isn't it kind of off-putting and worrisome that perhaps an entire generation of people will have their understanding of the events in Selma and Montgomery through the eyes of this movie, and they're not going to read Taylor Branch's King trilogy, perhaps. They're not going to, you know, delve into it as deeply. And if Johnson is, in fact, and I haven't seen the movie yet, but I just have heard from folks other than you guys about how powerful it is. But, you know, if in fact, Johnson is demonized unfairly, for example, the movie seems to indicate that Johnson's the one who directs Herbert Hoover to do the surveillance of Dr. King.
J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover. Yeah, right. And that's not true. You know, and Taylor Branch certainly writes extensively about that in his thing. But Anne, is that worrisome to you that, you know, there are going to be people whose understanding of history is shaped by this movie rather than the voluminous, you know, literature about this period?
Well, it's not. I don't think that you know the what about the children argument is compelling, but I don't think it should. I don't know what to do with that in terms of an artist. You know, this is an artistic medium. Now, we don't ask the same of the writers of historical fiction, people like Tom Mallon, who does it so brilliantly and playfully. We don't ask these questions of painters. I mean, cinema and the medium of film has an extra onus on it just because of its realism and because of the deep sort of psychological experience and embedding that happens when you do see a film. It is a powerful medium. But as Jed said, every movie we see is made from a point of view, and that's what makes a great movie. I mean, Captain Phillips last year was told
about the Somali pirates.
Right. I mean, that had it. I interviewed Paul Greengrass because he's done a lot of fact-based drama. And, you know, he, even though something looks neutral, quote-unquote, or objective, quote-unquote, or eagle's eye view historic, it's always being done through an artist's point of view. And if it doesn't have a strong point of view, it fails. So I take your point that the realism of film has an added layer of urgency to it in terms of people being literate, but I do think it's an issue of media literacy more than I don't know how we police artists, you know, to make sure that they're getting everything right or which facts to leave in and which facts, you know. I remember hearing somebody say, you know, Lincoln always has to be tall. You know, I mean, there are certain historical realities, objective realities that have to obtain, but I would hate, I don't know, I don't know what the answer to that is. You know, do we issue licenses for, you know, filmmakers dealing with certain subjects that they have to hit all these boxes?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, the movie is available. It opens today nationwide. I think it's in the Anne Arundel theaters down by the airport here in Baltimore. Selma, make sure you see that. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking movies this morning with Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival, who's here in the studio, and Anne Hornaday on the line from Iowa. Anne is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed, another movie that's getting a lot of buzz called Inherent Vice. This is a film adaptation of a Thomas Pynchon novel. It takes place in the 1970s, an L.A. detective story. Joaquin Phoenix plays the detective Paul Thomas Anderson, the director. What do you think of this movie?
I loved it. It's a completely nutty story. As a matter of fact, I would even argue you don't have to spend too much time worrying about the plot because it'll probably lose you at some point. But it's full of a portrayal of Los Angeles at a very specific period of time in which a lot of chickens were coming home to roost from around that culture, and probably specifically West LA, to be honest. And Joaquin, I think, is just a great job. I mean, it's sort of a Raymond Chandler meets Big Lebowski. And but I think it really, in the film, I haven't read the book, in Paul Thomas Anderson and the cast, Martin Short's in it brilliantly. Josh Brolin does an incredible job. Sam Waterston's daughter, Catherine Waterston, has a central role and is terrific in it. I think it really works. It's completely crazy, but I thought it really worked.
Anne, have you seen it? Inherent Vice, what's your take?
Agreed. I just loved the experience of watching this movie. It is just a trip. And I think what makes it work is that it's so cockamamie and kind of self-consciously wacky that it would have been easy for another director to really play that up and hit it too hard and step on the gas, you know, and heighten the irony and heighten the cynicism and heighten the kind of winks and references and stylization. And instead, Paul Thomas Anderson goes for tenderness and humanism. Yeah. There's this underlying note of the end of an era. You know, it's the end of 60s idealism. It's the end of political idealism and counterculture idealism that's kind of running straight into this new era of political paranoia. It's around everyone's been infected by the Manson murders, and you can sort of see the beginnings of a surveillance state. You can see the beginnings of that deep mistrust between police and communities of color that we're living with today. So it's got this kind of mournful, prescient note to it that I think saves it from being just a fun kind of little, you know, snarky little smirky little one-off. And as Jed said, the performances are absolutely thoroughgoingly wonderful. Owen Wilson is, and I don't want to say who plays whom, because they just come out of nowhere and they surprise you, and it's just really beguiling and beautiful to watch and beautiful to listen to. Johnny Greenwood just composed a gorgeous musical score to go along with it. So it's just a pleasure. It hits all the pleasure centers.
All right, so two big ones, Selma and Inherent Vice. Let's talk a little bit about A Most Violent Year. Yeah. It takes place in New York in 1981, which I guess is statistically one of the most violent years in that city. The levels of violence have diminished dramatically since that time, although, you know, of course, New York very much in the news these last few weeks because of what's going on there and the tensions around the police department. Jed, what do you think? This is a movie directed by J.C. Chander, and it also stars, again, David Oyelowo, who seems to be all over the place. He plays Dr. King in Selma, and he plays one of the main characters in this movie.
Yeah, he plays a prosecutor in this movie. So J.C. Chander has made, this is his third movie. He did Margin Call, about a business collapsing, an investment bank collapsing. And then he did All Is Lost, a one-person movie with Robert Redford with almost literally no dialogue in it. And I think, and then this one. And Oscar Isaac stars as Abe Morales. And I point that out because Oscar Isaac was Llewyn Davis in the Coen Brothers movie. And you won't know that unless I point it out to you, because he's completely different in this movie. And I think Chander is just fascinated by people under pressure and then under more pressure and then under more pressure and how they handle it. And as a director, writer-director depicting business, which I think is often distorted in movies and cartooned in movies, I think he is singular. I don't think there's anybody who understands the responsibilities and weight of running businesses and dealing with the twists and turns that happen to you the way he does. And he, on top of that, and most importantly, of course, makes the story so incredibly dramatic. It's just wonderful. It's also, I have to point out, these two movies, Inherent Vice and A Most Violent Year, have completely different cinematographic visual goals. And this one's shot by a guy named Bradford Young, who shot a movie that was our closing night film a couple years ago at the festival called Mother of George. And he's an incredible cinematographer. And he has captured this sort of grimy, slightly dark, cloudy feel that New York, I think, really depicts New York, especially in 1981 with the graffiti and all the stuff it was going through, as Robert Elswit, who did Inherent Vice, captures that constant infusion of light that you feel always in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I just think, again, these performances, Oscar Isaac is magnificent. Jessica Chastain is terrific. I can't say enough. I think it's a great movie.
And, you know, so another period piece, as it were, not about the 70s, like Inherent Vice. This is about the 80s, but evidently he captures it pretty well, huh?
Yeah, the 80s, which aren't really yet, I don't think, codified as a quote-unquote, you know, recognizable era in terms of visual tropes or cues. So I think he's kind of forging new ground.
Shoulder pads.
In terms of a period piece. And I want to also say that I'm a huge fan of Brad Young, who also shot Selma, by the way. So if you see Selma in A Violent Year, you're going to be able to see Young doing, you know, working in very different visual languages, but but just and I agree with Jed that the performance, I think the mood of it and the performance has worked better for me than the narrative. But it's just it's a deep plunge, and it's a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. Cool. Just got 1 minute here. Jed, have you seen Into the Woods?
Yes.
This is the musical adaptation of the Sondheim musical.
Yeah, with Meryl Streep and Emily Blunt, who are both wonderful in it. I am not a big fan of this musical. I like Sondheim, but this is not one of the ones I like a lot. I saw it with a full house, very mixed audience, ages, race, and the audience really loved it. It's a hit. I mean, if you like musicals, I'd go see it. It's beautifully staged. Mm-hmm. Not my favorite musical, though.
Anne, are you a hoofer at heart? You like musicals, and you like this one?
I do. Well, I generally kind of have a love-hate relationship, but I don't think Rob Marshall is a very good director. I just don't. Mm-hmm. But in this case, he didn't screw it up, which is what everybody was afraid of. It's not. I wouldn't call it an inspired film directorially, but he's cast it wonderfully. Emily Blunt, Anna Kendrick is magic.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Chris Pine is the big surprise.
And a bunch of award nominations for that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's all the time we got. I'm afraid we're going to have to call it a day there, but we shall see you next month. Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post, Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival. Many thanks, and we'll see you soon.
Good to see you.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
And as you've been hearing this morning, NPR has been reporting for the last few hours on the latest in the efforts to apprehend Saeed Kouachi and Sherif Kouachi, the two main suspects in the terrorist attack in Paris on Wednesday, in which 12 people were killed at the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. The suspects are holed up in a printing company near Charles de Gaulle Airport, and they are holding at least one, maybe as many as 7 hostages. There is at this hour a second hostage situation in a kosher grocery store in Paris. It appears that at least one gunman is holding hostages there as well. French police have identified a man named Amédée Coulibaly and his former girlfriend, Ayette Boumediene, as suspects in the shooting of a police officer yesterday. It is suspected that Coulibaly is the person holding hostages in the kosher store in Paris. Joining me now in Studio A is Kevin Kelleher, known as Cal to his legions of fans around the globe. He's one of the most frequently published political cartoonists in the world. His work has appeared in more than 100 publications, including The Economist, where he has been the resident cartoonist since 1978. In 2013, he published a book called Daggers Drawn, 35 Years of Cal Cartoons, which features more than 300 of his award-winning Economist creations. He's also the political cartoonist for the Baltimore Sun. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
So, a sad day for the world, and particularly for people in your business. Did you know any of the cartoonists who were murdered on Wednesday?
I did have the opportunity to meet several of them. We're a pretty small community, the cartoon world around. We maybe have several hundred practitioners around the globe, and we gather in events and festivals. And France is actually one of the centerpieces for this. They have events on an annual basis, and cartoons get together.
And you were, for a time, president of an organization, and you're still a member of an organization called the Cartoonist Rights Network International. Tell us about that group and what they do.
It's a group that basically tries to protect cartoonists in trouble around the world. And it may surprise people that, you know, cartoonists can cause such trouble. And actually, in light of what happened yesterday, I think this is something that we've been very aware of, the kind of trouble cartoons can get in. But many people have just learning this for the first time, that, you know, cartoonists are often jailed and tortured and murdered for their work because you're right in the front line of freedom of expression. And in societies that are far less free than where we live here in the United States, the fist of authority comes down right on the cartoonists, because I guess pictures can go places that words can't.
Talk a little bit about that. I mean, the sensitivity that you have, you know, having been in this business for such a long time. What is it that what do you think it is that makes these cartoons resonate, you know, on a sort of visceral level in a way that an essay or an op-ed would not?
You know, I said a really interesting question a lot of people have been asking. And a couple of years ago, a guy named Victor Navrasky, who is the former editor of The Nation, upon retirement, set upon to do a book about this very subject because he found that cartoons in his years of being a journalist were things that elicited the most amount of reaction from people. And he had a couple of interesting conclusions. One, he said that when someone submits a cartoon against someone, that there is no answer for it. You can't retaliate with another cartoon. Mm-hmm. And words don't quite fit the frame. The second thing is that pictures somehow go straight to the brain and etch themselves in a very strong way, in the way that words don't. You know, cartoons are often absorbed in about 5 seconds, and they give a whole host of messages. And cartoons also deal with ridicule and caricature, and so that the force driving them is one of, I guess, negativity. And so people respond in a visceral and often unhappy reaction to them.
It's been a difficult time period for journalists in general, more journalists imprisoned or killed in the last year than in any time in recent memory. And we should also, you know, point out that, for example, today in Saudi Arabia, a young man named Rauf Badawi, who's been incarcerated in Saudi Arabia since 2012. He's sentenced to 1,000 lashes and 10 years in jail. He was flogged 50 times. They're going to do this once a week until he gets up to his 1,000 because he started a website called the Liberal Saudi Network. You know, so we've got state-sponsored suppression of free speech as well. You know, in this climate, do you think it's going to dampen the resolve of cartoonists and editorialists around the world? We note, for example, that the New York Times and CNN and other major news organizations are refusing to show the images that Charlie Hebdo is planning to publish next Wednesday, when that first edition after this the terrorist attacks comes out. People are making judgments about this, and it seems to be directly related to this act of terrorism.
True. I think that we are going to be facing some very challenging times ahead, in part because now with the internet, there's no such thing as local news, because whenever you do a cartoon or an article, it goes global. And as a result, people have to are becoming aware of what that might imply as far as, you know, threatening their lives. But I've also been heartened by the reaction of the past 24 hours by the world and by a lot of leaders to this terrible incident that took place in Paris, this rallying to the notion of freedom of expression and understanding the value that it has, and also, you know, the incredible role that cartoonists have in this. You know, we are so incredibly lucky that we can say what we do in this country, and we can sit in this room today and not worry the police are going to march in. And in the history of mankind, it's actually been just such a small period where this is allowed to happen. And I believe that when people see it under threat, that they're going to rally and fight for it. But there's going to be a lot of skirmishes and there's going to be a lot of battles. And we had a setback yesterday, but I think that it doesn't mean it's going to carry on in that direction.
Je suis Charlie. Huh? Mm. The T-shirt will be the thing that we remember perhaps more than the murders themselves. Well, Cal, thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
And we'll see you the next time. Cal's latest book is called Daggers Drawn, 35 Years of Cal Cartoons. Come to our website for a link to more information, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us this morning. On Monday, Sheila will speak with former Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review the latest production at the Single Carrot Theater. Hope to have you with us on Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville.
on the web at zekescoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1971, the Maryland Terps basketball team upset number 2-ranked South Carolina. Maryland led 4-3 at the half, final score 31-30. We're back Monday. Hope you will be too.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're @MarylandMorning.